This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time.
Anne Boost is the author of a number of erotic fiction novels, plus the psychological thrillers Medea's Curse, Dangerous to Know, This I Would Kill For, and The Long Shadow. She is a professor of women's mental health at the University of Melbourne. She also lives with Graham Simpson, the author of The Rosie Project, and together they have co-authored Two Steps Forward and Two Steps Onward. They live in Melbourne, Australia.
Anne, you easily have the most varied writing career of anyone that we've had on this show. I feel like we have a lot to talk about. But if we start with the writing itself, is it something that's always been a part of your life?
Well, thanks for the invitation to come along. Yes, writing has always been, writing and reading. I got given a whole pile of Enid Blyton books when a little private library closed down just near where I was living when I was about 7 or 8. And I vividly remember sitting in the back of the car, it was a station wagon, we wouldn't be allowed to do that these days, sitting with all these books on me, and this was heaven as far as I was concerned. But while I read these books and then I'd write my own, which usually didn't get past the first page, I wrote lots of first paragraphs. And then at about 13, I wrote, I think, what I thought were full-length novels, but they were handwritten. And I've still got them. Looking back on them, they're probably, I don't know, maybe 20,000 words. And they're truly, truly awful.
20,000 words is very impressive at that age.
Yes, but the quality was not.
Well, you hit one part of it. You hit the quantity. Do you remember the first thing you had published?
Well, it would have been nonfiction. So I had journal articles and I had a nonfiction book published well before I published fiction. And certainly the first fiction book, yes, I still have. I really rather no one knew about it because it's not anything that I would recommend to anyone. But I was very excited about it at the time.
Now, is this, we mentioned this off air, is this first fiction book, is it a work of erotic fiction?
It is, and it didn't appear under my name. My husband is very smart with anagrams and came up with an anagram of my married name that worked brilliantly for erotic fiction. And whilst it was an erotic publisher a publisher of erotic fiction, which, you know, had very strict guidelines of what you were allowed to do, so it had to fit that, but they let me write crime in the background of the book. So all of them have a crime. Yes, there was lots of sex, quite explicit sex, and quite different men. In fact, my first heroine was very, a little bit perhaps too friggin' easy, but it was a lot of fun, throwing all things to the wind. But there was a crime going on, and I think there was a total of 10 of those. Three with the same heroine and then the others were just one-offs, including ones which was a particular sub-brand of erotica where you had two men and one woman. I figured my imagination could go that far. Some of them actually had something like 8 men and one woman. My imagination was not up to that.
Wow.
And I also did some paranormal. Everyone breaks up laughing when they think about this, but I had Tasmanian devils turning into hunky men, like werewolf kind of thing.
Oh, my God. This is incredible.
My imagination completely went wild. It's a lot of fun, but more to the point, it was good practice. So I would have done a couple of short courses I did, combined that with writing those 10 novels, and they were full-length novels. I would have got my 10,000 hours. Which really requires you to be a basic novelist, as far as I'm concerned. And then I continue, I've now done 5, I think, or 4 and 2 halves, or 4, just submitted the 5th book in my own name to the publisher. I haven't heard back yet, but that's 4th in the Natalie King series. And then, of course, there's the two books I've co-written with my husband. And I'm still learning.
So, I mean, erotic fiction is a really interesting starting point. Am I right in thinking that when your first book came out, this was the same time as 50 Shades of Grey? Was it around that?
It was around then, but it was before. Yeah, it was definitely okay. Before. Because I remember when 50 Shades came out, I thought, well, while I'm writing in this genre, I better read it. So I only read it because I was already writing in the genre. And, yeah, I was unable to work out really why it was so successful or certainly wasn't anything I was going to aspire to. But by that stage in the background, I was writing The Day Is Cursed, my first one I was prepared to put my real name to. So I knew I was not going to stick with erotica if I could get mainstream crime fiction, psychological thrillers published, but I was doing that slowly in the background.
How interesting. As you've mentioned, you've written a lot of books and a lot of different type of books. When you were purely writing erotic fiction, was it a different experience being an author?
Very different to being a mainstream author. Well, it was not a vanity publisher. It was a publisher based in Austin, Texas. So I never actually got to meet them. So it was all online. So that was kind of, and of course, it's not in mainstream bookshops. So all sales are online, and it's certainly downloadable as like an ebook. But you could order a book, like a real book, but it was printed to order basically. And actually, it's not true. There was a good sense of community. Because all of the siren authors were a really good online community. And that was when I first got on Facebook, and really all my Facebook friends were siren authors. And I got to read a lot of theirs. We were all reading each other's books. And it was an interesting experience. But ultimately, I mean, I think it was both the subject matter, i.e. the erotica versus the crime. It was too bit too trite at the end. But interestingly, I think there was, because most of the readers, I think, were Midwestern Americans, and they had very strong moral guidelines in one respect, in the sense that you had to have safe sex. You couldn't have no sex with animals, no rape scenes. You know, there was kind of quite strong guidelines, even though they would allow you to have sex with multiple men, as long as it was all consensual and everyone knew about it. So it was kind of an interesting sort of way of introducing sort of different ideas of sexuality to people. And as a doctor, I feel like I've heard it all. Maybe I haven't. But certainly over the years, I've heard lots and lots of different stories firsthand and know that there's a lot of diversity that works different ways for different people. So I didn't have any problems with the sex. But ultimately, they were a bit too light without a deeper level for me. And even though I now write crime/psychological thrillers, you can just read them like that. And likewise, the books I've written with Graham, you can read them as the superficial if you like. Mm. But they've all actually got a layer or two underneath. Pretty much in all of my ones I've written by myself, like the Natalie King ones and The Long Shadow, have an ethical or moral question that she as a psychiatrist, or in the other book, the psychologist, has to ask themselves and make a decision. And they don't tend to always make the decisions that I would. In fact, quite the opposite at times. They don't do the things that I would have done, though I have them being ethical within there. They don't put the patients in danger, but they have a different set of, not necessarily exactly the same as what I would do. To get people to question things. So, I think it's an interesting part of crime books can do that. You don't have to pay attention to that. You can just turn the pages and find out who did it, but then it has this other aspect if you want to look at that.
It's interesting because you obviously work or have worked in psychiatry, mental health. So we can certainly see in those books how that real life experience informs the world. One of the things that's very interesting to me is that the psychiatrist, psychologist, protagonists also have mental health issues. Can you tell me a little bit about the kind of debate in your head about deciding to include that?
So with Natalie, which is my kind of main heroine of most of the books, She started off, well, she was going to be a biker, and I don't ride a motorbike, but I just had this picture of who I wanted her to be in, a really out there, edgy kind of person. But then I sort of thought, we were kind of tossing around with my husband, because we do a lot of planning together, about, you know, what's her struggle going to be? In crime books, the hero, heroine often has something. They're either alcoholic or depressed or something. Not perhaps a little bit less these days. So we've got some more straight heroes and heroines these days, but I was still kind of wanted a point of difference. And at one stage she was going to have one leg because she'd come off a bike and lost a leg. But then I thought, I really know nothing about life with one leg.
We're so cruel to protagonists.
I could have gone and researched it. But Graham rightly said, why don't you write something you know? Give her a mental health condition. And I went, ooh, okay. And bipolar was the obvious one because I deal with bipolar a lot in perinatal because it's a high risk of relapse after having a baby, partly because you go off your meds for the baby's sake, or in some cases, and partly because sleep deprivation is a trigger. So bipolar seemed to be the obvious one to give her, and it's also the one that I've dealt with a lot of professionals. I mean, I've heard that there's classic stories of both barrister and judge in court having a manic episode at the same time and the whole thing having to be redone. It's quite a high rate in, relatively high rate in higher socioeconomic, as opposed to schizophrenia, which tends to head a little, well, at least after the getting the illness, particularly if it's not treated, you can have a low socioeconomic kind of decline. Whereas bipolar tends to be creative, a lot of possible co-genes with writing, writers, lots of famous writers thought to have had, and their families thought to have had bipolar, and actors too. But I've certainly dealt with a number of doctors and a number of lawyers that have bipolar. So it seemed the obvious kind of one to give her. And also it gave the opportunity, I don't want people laughing at mental illness, but crime books can get a bit serious, and particularly as the first one is about infanticide. I didn't want everyone to be sort of stuck in this dreadful spot of agonising over how anyone could kill a child and how dreadful this is. And what. Of course you do have to feel that, but you can't have a whole book like that. Mm. People are going to put it down and not want to pick it up again. So having some sort of slightly hypermanic times, particularly when she's playing in her band, gives a bit of life. And I avoid her getting into too much trouble. I sort of allude to her, you know, after the first diagnosis, she gets into much more trouble back in the past. Now she, and there's an arc over the books, which is common for the people I've treated with bipolar, is when early on in the diagnosis, they think they can manage it. They play around with their meds. They like having the hypermania mania. So they kind of pull their doses down when it suits them, add it in. And as a psychiatrist, she was definitely going to do that. I mean, I could imagine, I don't have bipolar, but I could imagine doing that. But then through the course of the books, without giving too much away, she has a baby, and it adds an extra level of responsibility, but she can't do that anymore. And so the latest one I've just sent into the publisher, she's in a mother baby unit or sleep school with her 1-year-old who's not sleeping, and you know, this is diabolical for her bipolar disorder. And you know, she's really careful with the meds, but even being careful with the meds, if your kid's waking you up all the time, you risk relapsing. So she's kind of background. And it gave me something, you know, that her struggle separate, which helps her potentially understand her patients better as well. In the other one, The Long Shadow, which is a standalone one, I have a psychologist heroine. And I she would have, if you call her having a disorder, would be a high prevalence disorder, meaning most people could relate to her. There's issues of difficulties in her marriage. She's got some anxiety and certainly was treated for that, but it's kind of largely over that. And it's repairing and managing the grief of what she's happened in the past and how forward with that, which I think is easier to identify with. But again, it gave her a particular struggle that she had to overcome. And I think we like that in our hero's journey. We have not just they have to find whodunit, but that there's other challenges for them as well.
So, I mean, you obviously know a lot about the reality of having mental illnesses, having worked so closely with people. Is it difficult to balance truth with fiction? Is there ever a tension between those two things?
Yeah. I think there is. Medea's Curse started out as nonfiction. I was really a bit annoyed by media sensationalising infanticide cases. I have to say, I think they're a little bit better these days, though the splashed kind all over the newspaper about the woman who drove her children into the dam was a bit on the sensationalised side without the depth in there, though Helen Garner writes quite eloquently with a lot more depth. So I wanted to write a non-fiction book kind of showing the different aspects of how someone might come to kill their child. And there's different illnesses, different aspects. So the pregnancy denial, for instance, tends to be young girls, and they often just leave the baby, or as soon as the baby's delivered, no one knows they had a baby. So there's that group. But then there's a group with postnatal depression, with postpartum psychosis, and then there's the disorder, drug abusing, in a violent relationship group. So I wanted to kind of bring all of that to life. And I tried to fictionalise real cases. It became impossible. And Irvin Yalom is a psychiatrist from New York, who writes about his patients, and I think he even uses their names. And I gather the patients kind of fight for the privilege to be in his books. And I thought, well, I could go to those patients or the people I'd seen in these infanticide cases and ask permission. But then I thought, what would it feel like for, them walking past the bookshop and seeing that book constantly? I mean, not that it would necessarily be there. I was thinking of House of Grief, Helen Garner's in particular, because it was in the bookshops a lot. It was very visible. And for that poor woman who, the mother of those little boys that got drowned, you know, what would that be like seeing that? So I thought the last thing I want to do as a psychiatrist is traumatise my patients. And really this was about decreasing stigma, helping people understand more with a ripping story as well. So canned the idea of having it as nonfiction and then totally fictionalised it. And then the risk I ended up with is there are some commonalities in people that I see, and are they all going to see themselves? Like, for instance, one of them in Medea's Curse has a borderline personality disorder. And if you look up DSM-5, it has all the points of, you know, what people with borderline personality disorder are likely to act like. So every case I put of someone with borderline personality disorder is going to have that in common. But they're also going to have a lot of different things. They're also, you know, collect matchbox cars, or, you know, do something weird. Not weird, but something different that's out of keeping with their disorder. They're not just their personality disorder, but are they going to kind of see the commonalities and think it's them? And I guess that's a risk, but it isn't. There isn't any one patient that's, you know, I think, ha-ha, I know who that is, that's so-and-so. And I know a lot of my colleagues thought they recognised the professor of psychiatry in Wadwa in my book. And when they said that who they thought it was, I went, huh? No, it's not.
How funny.
I'd say it was about 30% of someone else I've been thinking of, but no one has ever picked the 30% of the person that I kind of helped me inform that character. And of course, everyone says it's 30% fiction, 30% someone, and 30% yourself in all of your characters. And that's quite a bit of a stir up of a pot and mix up, get different people.
I haven't heard of that statistical breakdown before, but it sounds...
I've heard other people say it. Yes.
So, Anne, for the books that you write on your own, what does the writing process look like?
Look, I certainly plan, not as much as I plan co-books, co-authored books, but there is certainly a plan. I know my characters. I don't necessarily know what their favourite colour is, but I do know them intimately, and certainly with Natalie, the whole beauty is that there's a return of several characters in each book, and I get to know them more and more, which makes sequels so much easier to write and a lot of fun. My daughter loves the latest one because I bring back Natalie's sister, who's also had a baby. So there is so much rivalry and then working it through. And Madison is very different to Natalie. So they have all of these and kind of a lot of fun sort of friction there, which helps turn the pages and kind of make it fun, as well as, you know, the whodunit. So you certainly plan the arc, roughly what my chapters are going to be. But unlike the absolute planner, my characters can take me places that differ. And what I find interesting is that sometimes, you know, halfway through the first draft, I go, wow, I could do this. I hadn't even realised I'd set it up, that there's this kind of little different, you know, either a completely different direction or a slightly different direction that I have the option of going. So there is a bit of a reassessment as I'm writing, with increasingly, like the one I've just done is I wrote the first draft, read it, made some pretty substantial changes, sent it out to first readers, and then got their feedback, which was all very similar about what they liked and what they struggled with, and then did a really big, you know, another really big rewrite with that. Not changing it entirely, but changing the order and changing how much you know about people at certain times. So that was really valuable feedback. And some have needed more change than others from that point of view.
And how have you found first readers? It's always a very hard role for a person.
Yeah, and over time I found the ones that work best for me. And it would be different ones from my crime books to the other books. The erotica, my daughter used to read them, but she only read every second chapter because they were the ones without sex. So she just read without the sex.
Was that your stipulation or her choice?
No, that was her. Right, because she advised me on the storylines and the characters without embarrassing her about what mum could write. But she's very astute. Having a psychologist son with a psychologist future daughter-in-law has been really helpful, particularly with The Long Shadow and with the current one, because it's set in Yarra Bend, or a lot of it's in Yarra Bend, which is the forensic hospital where my son actually currently works. So even though I have visited it, I'd never worked there. So it doesn't have to be exactly the same, but it was great running it past him saying, no, this wouldn't happen. No, there aren't guards in towers. Just the sort of stuff that I fictionalised. I just made it a bit more real.
So those are the books that you write yourself, but you and your husband, Graham Simpson, who authors will know as the author of The Rosie Project and other books, you guys write books together, something that I don't think all of us would attempt. Tell me how these came about.
We walked the Camino de Santiago, which is really how I certainly went back to writing, because I'd had a book at the last phase, a serious psychological drama at the last phase in Random House about in my late 30s, and got rejected at the sort of the last moment. At the same time, I got a research funding from Beyond Blue, so I sort of put fiction aside for 10 years and then basically was burnt out for a whole host of reasons. So took a year off, had 6 months sabbatical in New York and at Yale, which was fantastic, and then 6 months in France. But we thought that we were in danger of just sitting there eating and drinking and not doing anything much else, and saw this stylized scallop shell on the lamppost, found that if you followed these scallop shells across fields and fence posts and things, you'd find yourself in Santiago de Compostela in Spain. We thought that was ridiculous. It was way too far. But La Puy, only about 300 Ks further south. We'd done a little bit of like 2 week walks. So we thought 300 Ks would be the most we'd ever walked. Let's do that. It'll take us a couple of weeks. We'll feel good about ourselves and fit. And then we can drink and eat the rest of the long service plate.
It's perfect.
So we walked out our door, got to La Puy, looked at each other and said, this is really fun, let's keep going, and basically did the full 2,038 kilometres and walked all the way to Santiago de Compostela. Had an amazing experience. I had a literary epiphany that life was too short to work 12 hours every day as an academic, and it was time to go part-time. And I'm still very passionate about perinatal psychiatry, but I also balance that with writing fiction. So I then almost immediately whipped up the erotica and got that published, and then started working on something serious again in the background. So, but we both love the walk so much, we really wanted to write a book on it. So we started to toss around ideas about writing fiction, because there's lots of memoirs about the Camino, and we weren't going to compete with that. We thought, let's write fiction. I mean, Paulo Coelho has written a sort of lightly fictionalized story of his walk of the Camino. I think now there's a couple of other perhaps fiction ones out there that are not well known, but there wasn't anything that we could find apart from Paulo Coelho's. So we wanted to write this, and we couldn't really decide who was going to write it. So we both wrote it, thinking that our publisher would. So we had the same story, and I wrote the female point of view. He wrote the whole book from your point of view. The publisher said, this is really a stupid idea, and you put them together. And so we basically had to cut out half of each of our books and paste them in together, which was a pretty mammoth effort. And then, of course, we had to edit each other's to make sure the voices were right and make sure that the end of one chapter melded nicely with the beginning of the next one. So it was a bit of a messy process, but we got there and were quite, you know, the book was quite fun. And so we actually rewalked the walk with a slightly different ending along the traditional Camino Francis, but another like 1900 kilometres to just get more information and stories to put in it. And then we thought, well, we need to have a sequel. So on the same lamppost where the scallop show was in Cluny was a dove. If you follow the dove, it takes you to Assisi in Italy. So we thought, we'll go to Assisi and we'll do that walk and we'll have our characters doing it for some reason. So we actually nutted this one out. We knew it was going to be alternating chapters. We only wrote our own chapters, so we didn't make it quite as messy as it was the first time. And that changed a bit along the way because we realised in researching the walk that, in fact, the Assisi Trail hits another trail, which is slightly more not well-known, very ancient trail called Via Francigena, which comes from Canterbury to Rome. And we decided that they were actually aiming for Rome, not Assisi. So when they hit the Via Francigena, they swap paths. So they swap most of the way, but then they follow the little pilgrim all of the way down to Rome. So, and we realised that unlike the Camino, there wasn't going to be lots of walkers. So in Two Steps Forward, there are lots of bit part players, the Brazilian women, there's the Dan Bernard. They meet lots of other people along the way, which is very common when you're doing the Camino Francis, lots and lots of people, lots of stories, lots of people doing it to reassess their lives because they're grieving, just because they're lost. So we found quickly that there wasn't going to be anyone on this walk. I think we probably saw two pilgrims the whole time that we were on this walk.
Right.
So it's about 1,600 kilometres, this walk, from Cluny over the Alps, which was really hard work, and then you hit the Via Francigena in Tuscany, and then you go down south. So very different walk. So we decided we really needed the conflict and everything happening with who was walking. So besides our male female, we have four other characters. Camille, who is Zoe's good friend, and she's the reason they're all going on it. She's the only one who is religious, and she's doing a pilgrimage for the real classic reason. She is looking for forgiveness and a cure. So they're all going to support her, and we end up with Bernard, the annoying German that Martin hates, so therefore great, particularly when he gets attached to Martin's daughter who is there. And, of course, she's in conflict with Zoe, who might become the evil stepmother. So lots of room for conflict, lots of different reasons for going on the walk. And, again, they sort of discover lots about themselves, reinvention, and about friendship, particularly about our friendship. between Zoe and Camille.
So it sounds like you really think about the structure or the reader experience in terms of what a book needs. Is that something that you think about in terms of lighter moments and darker moments? Are you conscious of that, or does it sort of evolve?
It evolves. I mean, we tell the story we want to tell, but I think instinctively we both know we've got to keep the reader's interest. And Graham in particular is a very clean writer, and I think I'm learning and almost have learned to be a much cleaner writer from point of view of not waffling too much. Graham tends not, and his character, like Don Tillman, was not a character that was watching the, you know, the birds fly past and enjoying the plants and the scenery, whereas Zoe is. So, and I would tend to notice, and in the long shadow, you know, there's a real sense of country being part of the book, and that's not something that Graham does instinctively. So we kind of bring slightly different things to it there. But it's often on the reread that we then think, oh, this is getting a bit dull, we need to cut this. Graham's always trying to think, can we make this funnier? That's definitely his skill, not mine. Though I keep trying and he keeps looking at it and saying, yeah, well, I'll do something with that.
So yeah, how does it work? I mean, we all can be fairly sensitive about our work. Are you guys ruthless with each other? Do you have to be very sensitive? Is it sometimes one?
I have to be careful not to ask him for input when he's in a bad mood, because he can be quite ruthless. I'm not that sensitive. Well, we're pretty good with each other with that respect. And we both want the same thing. We both want the best possible book. So we know we're aiming for that. And as long as we've kind of got... See, we don't actually know what the themes are initially when we're first, not until we've got the first draft that the themes seem to emerge. And we might then talk about that. Are there better ways that we can bring it out? So that's again, more planning that, you know, even though the structure might already be there, that we can enhance it.
And what does the day look like for you two? Do you have set writing times? Do you sit next to each other? Are you in the same room?
It varies, and it varies at what stage of writing. Planning tends to be at 5 o'clock at night, 5 to 7, pre-dinner with a glass of wine. But sometimes on walks, and particularly if Graham's trying to plan something that's not working, he'll go for a walk and do it in his head. We can also, when we're actually plotting it all out, Graham likes cards. We've done that. We don't always do that. We have lots of cards around the floor, and we did this in Morocco for Two Steps Onward, because we had a long time in Morocco, loved Morocco, but we'd spend half of the day with these cards, kind of putting them around. The cards have a scene each on them, and we're just kind of where they would best go. So that can happen sort of all day, and that's together. Then when we're actually writing, that's a very personal kind of process, and there are places we prefer to. Graham doesn't tend to like his office. I can do it in my office, but we both prefer our place up country where we're in the same room. There's only one lounge room, fire's on if it's this time of year, and we're mostly immersed. If I'm on a roll, now I can write for 10 hours straight, so we wouldn't... just a half day or anything, but on other days I might not. I might do something else, get a bit of a break, do a bit of exercise, and then maybe 3-4 hours in an afternoon. So that's the first draft. Second draft is a bit like that as well, after you've had a sort of chance to reread. By that stage, we'd probably be reading each other's work and giving feedback. And then the editing process, you really can do anywhere at this stage. If it's not actually creative, you're in the sense of new ideas, you're making it cleaner, then we can do it on aeroplanes, not quite in front of the television, music in the background sometimes, you know, lots of places for that.
I feel like it could be hard at times to be in a relationship with another writer, but then I think we probably all experience that jealousy or competition in different ways, regardless of whether or not it's the person that's our partner. So I'm not asking this in relation to Graham necessarily, but do you experience those feelings of competitiveness or jealousies? And if you do, how do you manage them?
Look, I didn't with Graham. We were just so blown out of the... Neither of us expected the Rosie Project to do what it did. And, wow, what an amazing experience. And what an amazing thing it's done for the autism community, because it's given them a hero that we laugh with, not at, that is often right. He's very sensible. It's often us that are idiots for thinking, you know, the cultural kind of norms and stuff we add to our lives. So... I think that's fantastic. And if they make it a half-decent film, that will also be wonderful. And I'm just very happy to share in that joy. It's not a book I could have written. It was so, in that sense, he occasionally mumbles about writing crime and I glare at him a lot. I might not be with that. There was just total bewilderment with the 50 Shades of Grey, I have to say. It's like, huh? And I didn't ultimately really want to write erotica anyway. But there's times I've been disappointed that, you know, my thing wasn't shortlisted, my book wasn't shortlisted. I put a load of effort into it, and comparing mine to, as objectively as one can, to the ones on the shortlist, I think, yeah, I don't agree with you. But by and large, you know, Jane Harper's The Dry is a very good, and I can understand why men would read it. And I'm not particularly male-friendly, a lot of my books. They're very female, babies, mothers groups, et cetera. And D'Urville Maternant's, fabulous books. You know, if I could have, there's just no doubt that her book would win over mine. And I'm writing for general enjoyment, you know, and that's really what I want. I just want people to read them. You know, I'd like more to sell for that reason. But the main reason I want them to sell is so my publisher will keep publishing me. I'm really enjoying it. And if, you know, I don't sell enough, I won't keep getting published. But I do hope there's some sort of, you know, enough getting out there that people enjoy it, that maybe it helps bring a little bit of stigma down about women who kill their babies, about bipolar disorder, about things that I know from a way that other people don't, or, you know, general public don't, that I can bring. And, you know, I don't really expect to win prizes, so it's not what I'm aiming for.
That's a great answer.
I don't want Graham running crime.
Yeah, tell him. Yeah. Stick to what you know, Graham. And you've already given some advice, but it's something that we really seek out on this show for listeners, many of whom are writers. Do you have any pearls of wisdom either about writing itself or the head game that is being a writer?
I think there's a lot to be said for the 10,000 hours. Do a lot of practice. And for how what that looks like, it's going to be different for different people. You know, some people, well, someone I know, got up at 5 a.m. and wrote for 2 hours every day because it was the only way to have a full-time job and run a family as well. And she ended up, she made it. She got published. She's just published it. So you've got to make it work for you. I mean, I wrote in my 30s when I had young children writing their books that got to the last phase of Random House. I wrote a page a day. It took me roughly an hour. Oh, and the best advice with regards to this is don't reread what you've written. Because if you reread what you've written, you'll just re-edit that and you'll stay on the same page. I need a plan. And if I've got a plan and I know where you're going, I'm going, you can't really have writer's block. And you just plow forward, even if you've got to lower your standards and write rubbish. What I tend to find is if I just do that, the rubbish lasts for a page or two, and by the time I'm into it, the writing level improves dramatically. I've only got to go back and rewrite those first couple of pages. You always rewrite the beginning of your book. So I would say do not spend too much time on your first draft on page one, because you will not end up like that. You will definitely rewrite, probably cut it out altogether. So forget about that. Just get going. And by page three, you might actually be on a roll. But without a plan, a lot of people are going to get stuck at 20,000 words. So that's where a plan helps.
That's good advice. I so understand that desire to perfect the first chapter from day one.
You can do that. And you need to do that because your publisher's only going to look at your first. You send it in, they're only going to look at page one and maybe the first chapter. But you don't do that on draft one. You do it when you've got your book. Then you do it.
Okay, final question, Anne. What is your favourite novel by a debut author?
Ooh. Oh, absolutely, no doubt. Just read Jacqueline Bublitz's Before You Knew My Name. It's out current. Absolutely wonderful. When I read the blurb, I was a bit, oh, come on. Crime is always from the victim point of view. It is an amazing book. It is totally victim focused, even though it's a crime book. Who did the crime? I can't remember. It was irrelevant. It was just so beautifully done. I think it's written, she's a feminist or whatever on the back cover. I hope that doesn't put off men, because it's not a man bashing book at all. But it really helps you live inside women who are afraid of men who have been in domestic violence relationships without being painful. It's just beautifully written with a feel of Lovely Bones, Alice Siebel's Lovely Bones, which is the point of view of the dead child, which I just adored. Well, this is very like that, with two female characters that written in first person. Yeah, I would strongly recommend it, even if you're not a crime reader. This is my current favourite debut author's book.
That's a good recommendation. Thank you, Anne, for being on the show today and for all of your generosity and wisdom.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at @thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.